Hello and welcome back to the History of Europe podcast. Last time we covered the Mesolithic period, and this time, even though we're a little late, we're going to step into the Neolithic, or New Stone Age. But first, that vintage new sound. That sound means it's time to start the Neolithic podcast. The Neolithic is the last part of the Stone Age and lasted in Europe from roughly 7000 BC to 1700 BC. It began with a rise of farming and animal husbandry and ended with the emergence of copper being used to make tools. The transition of the Mesolithic into the Neolithic came about when a culture discovered either farming or pottery. As such, there isn't an exact date when all of Europe suddenly became Neolithic. The same is true when it comes to the end of the Neolithic. Communities and groups ceased to be a Neolithic settlement when they started to mine copper and fashion it into useful or decorative stuff. When they made these tools or trinkets, they became a Chalcolithic culture. Since this changeover occurs when a discovery is made, not when a particular year occurs, some communities in Europe were Mesolithic while others were Neolithic, and some were Chalcolithic while others were Neolithic. There was even some Mesolithic communities living on the Iberian Peninsula when southeastern Europeans were becoming Chalcolithic. If that isn't confusing enough, there is evidence that Homo sapiens sapiens, mainly us, weren't the only human beings on the planet during the Neolithic time period. There were some pygmy men way out in the islands off the Southeast Asian coast when everyone decided to turn their calendar over to the Neolithic. Maybe. But I digress. The general dates for Neolithic Europe span roughly the 5,300 years or so I mentioned earlier, with Southeast Europeans experienced the Neolithic Revolution from about 7,000 BC to 3,000 BC, while Northern and Western Europe experienced a transition from around 4,500 BC to 1,700 BC. The Neolithic Revolution is basically the period of human beings transitioning from hunter-gatherer groups to agrarian societies. In short, man got tired of chasing down unpredictable animals to survive or relying on their mother goddess to give them enough wild berries and nuts to eat. So they sat down and started to farm and round up the aurochs, boars, and rams and turn them into cattle, pigs, and sheep that are much more manageable. Neolithic society is different regionally, but there are a couple things that can generally describe any of these Neolithic European societies. First, there is the presence of farming through the domestication of plants and animals. There's some debate over where this occurred first and if all the world developed from building on one another or if some communities developed independently or whatnot. But generally speaking, the first domestication of plants comes from the Levant region of the Near East. I was generally surprised to find that wild grain was not the first cultivated plant. I don't know why, I just always thought it was. But alas, a recent discovery in the ruins of Jericho has shown that figs were present that could not have been pollinated by bugs or birds, but would have had demanded pruning in order to bear fruit. So figs have become the oldest known cultivated food. It makes me want a Newton really badly. But that was in the Levant and not Europe. So let's move away from this dangerous slope until I slip into some long-winded stories and lose your interest. Cultures in the Levant would eventually have a big influence on Europe, either directly through a Mediterranean exchange or through the Levant's exchanges with Anatolia and then Anatolian influence on southeastern Europe. If you remember last time on the podcast about Mesolithic Europe, I mentioned, and I thought I would never have to say it again, so I apologize once again for my butchery, but we talked about the Franchitti Cave on the Peloponnesian Peninsula. The cave had been occupied 20,000 years ago deep into the Paleolithic, but was a site throughout the Mesolithic and is an early source of Neolithic material for us. In the cave we found domesticated plants from Asia Minor, predating the Greek domesticated wheat in it as well. This shows the cultural exchange between Greece and Asia Minor long before the Trojan War was even conceived in pre-Homeric utterances. Other early agrarian societies in Europe also seem to have an Anatolian connection. In southeast Albania, we find some of the earliest agrarian societies in Europe with strong Anatolian affinities. Other sites, like ones in Knossos and Thessaly, date from roughly the same time period that show cultural affinities to both Anatolian and Levantine sources. This could indicate that either they had direct influence in that Levantine and Anatolian groups settled there, or the Albanian groups moved down there, and when they reached overpopulation, or used the soil too much, or could have happened by magic or aliens or something. We can postulate, or rather people much smarter than I am can use DNA tools and long lists of letters after their names can postulate good sound theories. But the fact of the matter is, the scant evidence we have today makes it difficult to pin down the earliest Neolithic societies with any degree of absolute certainty. But we'll go ahead and do our best. From these early sites, the Neolithic Revolution would spread throughout Europe, sometimes rapidly, sometimes slowly. As with the Paleolithic and Mesolithic, though, there aren't nice and neat linear chronologies, and we'll have to dance around a bit. I'll do my best, though, to give it some sort of organization that is easy to follow. We'll divide the period into some chronologies and then proceed regionally as best we can. Last time on the Mesolithic show, we started in Northern Europe, so this time we'll start in Southeastern Europe. We'll do this partially to be fair, but mostly because the Neolithic began there first. We'll start in the Balkans and work our way north and west before heading back south again. Once we cover central to eastern Europe, we'll move back down to southern Europe, to be more specific, Italy and the Adriatic coast of Greece, and all the jazz that is right around there. Then we'll move up to central Europe again, and then to the west, and finally into the British Isles. This may take some time, so we'll probably have a short coffee or bathroom break somewhere in the middle. Unless, that is, of course, you aren't pretending that we're doing this live like I am. In that case, you can take a break whenever you want. We've already mentioned the cave on the Peloponnese, so we'll leave that one out. So let's head a little bit north to the region of Thessaly in modern Greece. This is where the Sesklo culture came together from the Mesolithic Proto-Sesklo and Pre-Sesklo cultures and inhabited Thessaly and Macedonia, not the Republic of Macedonia or the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, lest I offend any listening Greeks. But the Sesklo culture lasted in Greek Macedonia and Thessaly from around 6000 BC to 5000 BC. During this time, they built small wood or mud brick houses and villages on hilltops overlooking fertile valleys. In the valleys, they grew wheat and barley and kept sheep and goats. There was also domesticated cattle, pigs, and dogs, but much less than their beloved sheep and goats. And why not? That's what goes in a good euro, right? The houses would eventually become a bit more sophisticated, and there's evidence that they built the first two-story homes in Europe. They were also the first to create pottery, making cups and bowls that they decorated with brown and red geometric shapes. In addition to the bowls and cups, they created an abundance of pregnant women's statues, indicating some sort of fertility cult. The Sesklo culture would eventually give rise to the Karanovo culture in Bulgaria and the Starcevo-Koros-Kris cultures that span Serbia, Hungary, and Romania. The Sesklo culture would come to an end on account of the Domini culture, either through the Domini destruction of the Sesklo or by way of simple evolution and melding. The Domini culture would become a part of the Greek mythology when a Mycenaean palace was built there and became the city of Iolcos, I-O-L-C-O-S. The pronunciation isn't all that important, but what is important about it is it, according to the legend, it's where Jason and the Argonauts would embark on a mission for the Golden Fleece. Another early Neolithic culture was the Duseti culture in Romania. It lasted nearly 1,000 years, from around 6000 BC to 5000 BC, before splintering and reforming as the Hamangia culture, only to be overtaken by a Danubian culture called the Boian, which we'll discuss later. The Starcevo-Koros-Kris culture lasted from around 5500 to 4500 BC, but the Starcevo-Koros-Kris was actually a combination of three distinct communities that shared enough cultural affinity to be lumped together. The Starcevo culture was located in Serbia, the Koros culture was located in Hungary, and the Kris culture was located in Romania. But they also expanded into areas of present-day Bosnia and Herzegovina, Croatia, Kosovo, Montenegro, and the Republic of Macedonia. The actual former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, not the Greek region of Macedonia, lest I offend anyone. The main site of the Sarcevo culture is on the banks of the Danube. The culture made pottery, had some farming, but still liked to hunt, and created a distinctive spatula made out of bone that was found throughout all these three culture sites. The Starcevo-Koros-Kris cultures were also connected to the Pre-Sesklo, but apparently not the Proto-Sesklo culture in Thessaly, and the Kara-Nova culture in Bulgaria. The Kara-Nova spanned the Mesolithic, Neolithic, and Chalcolithic periods as the site near Kara-Nova, Bulgaria appears to have been continuously inhabited from around 7000 BC to 2000 BC. The Starševo culture was also connected with its Serbian neighbors, the Vinča cultures. The Vinča culture was centered mostly in Serbia, but it spread out in parts of Romania, Bulgaria, Bosnia, Montenegro, and the Republic of Macedonia and Greece along the Aegean Sea. It lasted from roughly 5500 BC to 4500 BC. Large settlements were set up and probably held together culturally by a vast trade network that spanned between the Aegean Sea and Hungary. The culture is likely derived of the older, but still contemporary, Starševo culture, but then they expanded on it greatly. The Vinča improved upon farming methods and may have even used the cattle-driven plow, a first in this region. They cultivated wheat, oat, flax, barley, and used cattle as draft animals and for meat and for milk. Whatever they did allowed for massive population for the time standards, and settlements as large as 2,500 people began to swell and became some of the largest cities, and I use that term loosely, in prehistoric Europe. The Vinča culture is distinguished by its settlement pattern and ritual behavior. Much of the ritual comes in the form of the Vinča figurines, indicating a fertility cult. They made obsidian works and had an obsession with spondylus shells. The Vinča culture was also master craftsmen. They improved upon pottery making and added lovely symbols to it through a firing method. They also wove cloth from flax and wool and made decorative and functional buttons from stones and shells. While they are not generally considered a Chalcolithic people group, they are also one of the earliest cultures to show signs of metallurgy technology. But the most fascinating part of their culture is the Vinča symbols. The Vinča symbols are scratches and scrawls they put on pottery. You can see a picture on the blog, thehistoryofeuropepodcast.blogspot.com. Basically, though, they are a bunch of scribbles that some people claim to be an early form of proto-writing. Some have even gone so far as to claim that that is the first written language, but there is not a lot of evidence to support this. Besides that, nobody is sure if the Vinča symbols are alphabet, syllabary, or ideogram in nature. Regardless, though, they are scrawled on one of the most interesting pieces of Neolithic European history, the Tartaria tablets. The Tartaria tablets are three tablets, two rectangular and one round, found in Tartaria, Romania, dating back to around 5300 BC. They were buried with a whole bunch of figurines, a bracelet, and the burnt remains of an adult male. There is speculation that this guy was a shaman and that these tablets are magical in nature. While the tablets are not very big, they represent a huge part of this ancient culture and give us some tantalizing glimpses into the religious life of the distant past. We could spend a whole podcast on some of these southeastern cultures, especially the Vinča, but that would leave us no time for their neighbors to the west and north. Some of the central European cultures will blend with some of those Balkan cultures we just talked about here in a minute or two, but we've got to back up for a minute. We'll head up to Central Europe and then we'll work our way back down towards the Vinča culture, and who the Vinča will eventually become through some cultural assimilation and transformations. So let's talk about the Danubian cultures. The term Danubian culture comes from Very Gordon Child, an Australian archaeologist and philologist from the early 20th century. His term is extremely useful for me, as we'll be using it to categorize some of the cultures we'll talk about this week. Danubian cultures were cultures that centered around the Danube River. It is an overarching term to describe a number of cultures we'll go into more detail in a moment, but covers roughly the linear pottery culture, stoked pottery culture, Langnau culture, Rosen culture, Boian culture, and the pre-Kukatani culture. Danubian cultures were some of the first agrarian societies in Eastern and Central Europe. They farmed from the Balkans to the Low Countries and all the way down to the Paris Basin. They made pottery and kept some domesticated animals like cows, pigs, dogs, sheep and goats. When they exhausted the fertility of the soil, they would move on to better lands. Successive waves of peoples would come then and occasionally come back to the land once it had rested enough and start the whole process again. Some of the Danubian cultures would eventually develop copper tools and thus become part of the Bronze Age, the Chalcolithic Age. So let's talk about the linear pottery culture. The linear pottery culture comes from around 5500 BC and lasts roughly until 4500 BC, and is also known as the linear bank ceramic in German, or LBK for short. Since I just butchered that word in German, we'll simply refer to them as the LBK. The LBK is an archaeological horizon, a fancy term that refers to cultural similarities spread out over huge geographical distances. As such, the LBK is a lot like the term Danubian, in that it is generalizing some cultures that are similar enough to be lumped together, but spread out enough to allow for some cultural variety. We'll focus on two of these varieties, the early or Western LBK and the Eastern LBK, also called the Buck culture. Before we get into that split, though, let's discuss some of the origin theories for the LBK culture. The LBK seems to have originated in the Middle Danube, in the areas of Bohemia, Moravia, and Hungary. From there, it spread across Central Europe using the rivers and focused mostly in the areas surrounding the Middle Danube, Upper and Middle Elbe, and Upper and Middle Rhine regions. Since the LBK was such a widespread culture, it developed into a whole host of cultures we'll talk about this week. Whether it was Western or Eastern, the LBK was an inland culture. It settled along rivers near fertile soil and shied away from the coastal regions of the Black Sea, Baltic Sea, and North Sea, despite having heavy presences in Poland, Germany, and even the Netherlands. There is some debate as to where the LBK come from. Some claim it developed out of the Starševo-Koros Krus cultures that were in Serbia and Hungary at the time. Others claim that it developed out of local Mesolithic cultures in the region. Still others claim that it was developed by some skinny Mediterranean that came up from the Balkan regions, rallying around the family with a pocket full of shells. We've mentioned those shells already in covering the Balkans and Southeast Europe. Also, whether it was early Western LBK or the Buck culture in the East, they farmed and domesticated animals in a similar fashion. They cultivated a couple types of wheat, peas, lentil, barley, millet, and rye. They domesticated animals like cattle, goat, pigs, and had a few dogs, but less than their contemporary Neolithic cultures. They supplemented their agricultural skills with time-tested hunts of wild boar and the various types of deer that roamed Europe at this time. Unlike the cultures that the LBK would spawn, though, there is no evidence of the use of metal tools, placing them firmly and conclusively in the Neolithic and not the subsequent Chalcolithic period. But they made fine tools out of stone and the flint that was prevalent in the Danube. They also mined obsidian in the Buck mountain regions of Hungary. The prevalence of obsidian in the West shows a further connection between the West LBK culture and the Eastern Buck. Now, a further note on those shells we've mentioned twice already. The shells were those of the spondylus, a mollusk from the Mediterranean. The pretty shells were so prevalent throughout the LBK culture and not indigenous to any of their areas that it is believed that they held some monetary value in trade. While this may be weak evidence to suggest that the LBK has Mediterranean origins, it is prevalent enough to suggest that the group had extensive trade with the Mediterranean groups. And the shells, they are rather pretty. The West had a different way of living than the East, though. The Western LBKs built long houses made of wood and wattle and daub. These homes were pretty big for single-family homes, so it's believed that the people lived communal-style. Villages often consisted of 5 to 8 of these communal homes, but there were some bigger, like the village in Oslonki, Poland, that dates to around the end of the LBK period and was enclosed with fortifications. Considering that the LBK culture is coined by the term pottery, pottery played an important part in the development of the culture. Pottery is found in homes and along many of the LBK sites. Women were actually buried with the pottery, indicating that the woman's role in creation of the pottery was important to society. The Eastern pottery was far better, but the methods of construction were basically the same. More on this in a second. In addition to being buried with pottery, there are a couple interesting things about burials in the LBK culture that point to a religious life. Women and children were often buried beneath the homes that suggest a belief in the afterlife or some continuation of life after death. Marija Gimbutas, a Lithuanian-American archaeologist, suggested that the burial sites were actually done in the shape of an egg, presumably so that the dead could be placed in a position to await their rebirth. Other religious artifacts found at LBK seem to be hangovers from the Paleolithic times. Venus statues and mother goddess idols are found at the sites, though not in massive quantities. So what was the big difference between the East and the West? The East, known as the Buk culture, was named for the Buk Mountains in Hungary. While there is debate as to the origins of the Buk culture, there is no debate as to the influence that the Buk culture had on their southern neighbors, the Starševo Koros in modern Serbia. Unlike the Western culture, the Buk built small, single-family homes that were often partially subterranean and cut out of the earth, something that you would see prevalently in the Starševo Koros Kris culture and the later Danubian culture, the Boian, in nearby Romania. The Buk distinguished themselves with pottery craftsmanship. While it was made in a similar fashion to the West, the East used sand rather than the chaff to temper the pottery, giving it a smoother and a finer texture. Also, they were able to create a much wider variety of pottery, and it was thinner and more delicately beautiful. Eventually, though, the East and West would splinter, and a number of cultures would spring from these early Neolithic pioneers. Before we move on to a number of cultures that were eventually spawned by the LBK and the Buk, let's talk about the pre-Cucuteni cultures of Romania. These were cultures that were heavily shaped by the Starševo Koros Kris cultures in the south and the Eastern Buk cultures in the west. But unlike the LBK, who feared living on the coast, most of the pre-Cucutenis liked to live along the Black Sea because the beaches are nice. These various cultures, though, would end up being swallowed up by the LBK and its offshoots, the Starševo Koros Kris culture to the south, and then this weird and incredible melding pot of cultures would arise, and the fascinating Cucuteni Tripilian culture would pop up to impress everyone thousands of years later. But we're getting a bit ahead of ourselves, so let's slow down and go back to the Danubian family and the offshoots of the LBK that way. One of the many offshoots of the LBK was the Stoke pottery culture, or the Stickbahn Keramik in German, the STK. The STK was much shorter-lived and much more localized, centering around Silesia, Poland, and eastern Germany, and the northern parts of the Czech Republic. It lasted roughly from 4600 BC to 4400 BC. They are differentiated from the earlier LBK and their contemporaries like the Larosan cultures to the west and the Langyol to the south by two main things. First, they like to paint their pottery with zigzags. Second, they preferred to cremate their dead, whereas the LBK used both cremation and burials. One of the most important STK culture sites is the Gosic Circle, just a little south of Berlin. It is a construction of double concentric rings around a circular ditch. Many have compared it to Stonehenge, only that it was made of wood. Some of the post holes in the rings are believed to mark positions of celestial bodies. The Gosic Circle, however, is not peculiar to Gosic. There are a whole mess of these places dotted across Germany, Austria, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic that can be associated with the STK or its predecessor, the LBK. The Rosen culture, that lasted from roughly 4600 to 4300 BC, is just another spin-off the preceding LBK. Its name comes from the necropolis of Rosen in the German state of Saxony-Anhalt. But the Rosen culture has been found in 11 of Germany's 16 states, northeast France, northern Switzerland, a bit of Austria, and the southeast of the Low Countries. The Rosen culture seems to have continued and improved upon many LBK features. For example, Rosen pottery had distinctive decorative incisions on it called the goat's foot incision because of its resemblance to a goat's hoof. The tools the Rosens used were very similar to the LBK, but the flint used was replaced. While the LBK used Dutch Reichhold flint to make tools, the Rosen mainly used Bavarian Plattenhornstein flint. The Rosen culture built similar longhouses to the LBKs, but were considerably longer, up to 65 meters in length. The sheer size of these houses suggests that they had continued on with the LBK tradition of having communal homes rather than single-family ones, unless the Rosens simply got their groove on better than most other Neolithic cultures. There are a number of Rosen villages that have earthen walls built around them as well, suggesting early needs to build protective communities.
The Boian culture, lasting from 4300 BC to 3500 BC, arose from the converging of two earlier Neolithic cultures, the STK culture of southern Poland and Ukraine, and the Dudeshti culture of Anatolia, making it another offspring of the LBK culture, though a bit more indirectly. It was also heavily influenced by the Starcevo culture in Romania. As such, the Boian could have been included in our discussion in southeastern Europe and the Balkans, but because it has been included in Child's grouping of Danubian cultures, I've decided to include it here instead. This inclusion is somewhat artificial and of my own choice to group, which highlights the nonlinear and tricky nature of classifying ancient people groups after the fact a few thousand years, but we'll proceed this way anyway. This convergence of Neolithic culture seems to have taken place in southern Romania, and the Boian culture coalesced together in the Wallachian plain on the northern banks of the Danube. The Boians would thrive for around 800 years and spread their culture eastward to the Danube Delta region along the Black Sea coast, then into southeast into Bulgaria until they stopped right around the Balkan mountain region and east until they hit the Jiu River that borders modern-day Transylvania, Romania, and south they went into Greece and had coastal settlements along the Aegean Sea. Since the culture largely settled around the Danube, it is considered part of the larger Danubian culture of the age. Rivers were important to the Boians as all of their settlements are along them and near floodplains that would help them to become more effective farmers. The Boians cultivated both plants and animals, including early domesticated cattle, goats, sheep, and pigs. They also had domesticated dogs, a mainstay of most Neolithic cultures, but way more important to the Boian culture than their preceding LBK culture. Though farming and animal husbandry were present in Boian culture, the desire to hunt was not extinguished, as good hunting was to be had in the region. The Boians hunted red deer, roe deer, wild horse, hare, beaver, wild boar, red fox, and badgers. Badgers? I won't do it, but I am very tempted. Okay, I'll do it. We don't need no stinking badgers. In addition to hunting, they liked to fish, and they ate a steady diet of freshwater mussels. The Boians have a number of stages that archaeologists like to assign to them. The early stages saw Boians created houses by digging out into the banks of rivers or on ledges and creating hobbit holes. Later in the culture, they built wooden houses with thatched roof. Inside these later houses, there is evidence of painted interiors, painted furniture, and indoor clay ovens, presumably to cook those delicious mussels. Boian pottery mimicked its predecessor cultures like by incorporating both Dudeshti and middle linear pottery elements. It seems, though, that as the culture wore on, they began to lose their potter's touch, as the newer pottery looks a bit shoddier. As the Boian culture was drawing to a close, however, they began to produce artifacts made from copper, indicating that the Boian culture became an early Chalcolithic or Copper Age society. The Boian culture would eventually fade into a number of other cultures like the Vadastra and the Gumlenta culture in Romania. Other Boians would push farther along the Black Sea and meet up with the Hamangia culture. The Hamangia culture was another Romanian Neolithic culture with ties to Anatolia. It was in decline by the time it came into contact with the Boians, but nonetheless, these two cultures would assimilate and influence the rising Kukuteni Tripilian culture that we talked about earlier. We'll talk about them later as well. The Langil culture is another direct offshoot from the preceding LBK culture, named after the centerpiece found in Langil, Hungary. It was a contemporary of the Funnelbeak culture in North Central Europe, the Tisza culture, which it overtook in Hungary, and the STK culture in Poland, lasting roughly from around 4000 BC to 3000 BC. Langil artifacts have been found in Hungary, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Austria, Slovenia, Poland, Croatia, and Serbia. It seems, though, that its influence on pottery making went even further as German and Swiss Neolithic cultures copied its style through trade and reproduction. The Langil culture carried on the traditions of both the Western LBK and the Eastern Buk. They built longhouses to hold multiple families and smaller single-family homes. These homes were organized into villages where they farmed and held domesticated animals, particularly cattle. Some of the villages had defensive ditches around them for protection. The Langille culture began to use copper towards the end of its existence, making it, as well, an early Chalcolithic culture. So now, we're going to close this all section off with a remarkable Cucuteni Tripilian culture of eastern Romania, Moldova, and Ukraine. The Cucuteni Tripilian culture would last from as early as 5500 BC through 2750 BC and span the Neolithic, Chalcolithic, and enter into the Bronze Age as well, stretching at its height from the Carpathian Mountains in Romania to the Dniester and Dnieper river regions of Ukraine. Archaeologists have found an astounding number of sites from this culture, as more than 3,000 sites have been identified. These sites were generally placed at only about 3 to 4 kilometers apart. Also, some of the cities were nothing to scoff at. A number of these cities, or proto-cities, had more than 10,000 inhabitants in them. One site had up to 15,000 people living in it, making it the largest Neolithic population in Europe. Most Cucuteni Tripilian cultures settlements were composed of three types of houses. First, there were the common wattle and daub homes. Second, there were various types of log homes. Last, the Cucuteni Tripilian culture built semi-underground homes called bordi. Bordi remained popular for a long time, considering there are still some places like Kansas that have bordi that date only from the 19th century. I'd say this technology that they seem to have invented was pretty close to timeless. Most of these homes had thatched roof. Some of these houses were two stories, and nearly all of them were decorated like Cucuteni Tripilian pottery. They were also well furnished with clay furniture and indoor ovens. Nearly all the settlements of the Cucuteni Tripilian culture were fortified with both natural and man-made barriers. The largest sites of the Cucuteni Tripilian were in the Ukraine at sites called Neblikvika, Mayenevels, Dobrovori, and Talinaki. I'm sorry if I just completely butchered those, but we'll do it again. Neblikvika was the oldest of these settlements, dating to around 4000 BC, and was the second largest at 740 acres in size. Dobrovori dates from around 3800 BC and potentially had up to 10,000 people living on its 600 acres. Mayenevels dates to around 3700 BC and also had potentially up to 10,000 people living in it. Incredibly, Talinaki spanned over 1,100 acres and had 15,000 people or more living in it. The city had over 2,700 structures, some of that measured nearly 600 meters tall. In comparison, the Empire State Building is about 381 meters tall. So why did the Cucuteni Tripilians build such large cities? There are a number of guesses, but here are the best three. A, they needed protection from the marauding tribes along the open steppes. B, there was just a natural progression towards big cities because of the protection they provided. The Cucuteni Tripilian culture was not politically unified, and it is likely that there was some infighting among people. So when you see a big city, you move to the big city because the big city is the safest thing. Or there was just the natural progression of why cities become larger today, because they provide more opportunities for work. Whether the settlement was large or small, the Cucuteni Tripilian culture relied heavily on farming. They cultivated wheat, oats, rye, millet, barley, peas, apricots, plums, and grapes. They also cultivated hemp, but strictly only for medicinal reasons. While they were primarily farmers, they did have some domesticated animals, primarily cattle. But there was also presence of swine, sheep, and goats. Oxen seemed to have been a part of their animal husbandry repertoire of the Cucuteni Tripilians as well, but solely to be used as draft animals. They also supplemented their diets through hunting using bow and arrows, traps, and camouflage to help them stalk prey. Aside from the massive settlements that rivaled anything contemporary Sumer had to offer in the size and population category, the Cucuteni Tripilian culture was known for its technological prowess. The Cucuteni Tripilian maintained the oldest salt mines in the world. They made beautiful textiles, which we only know of because of impressions on pottery, as the area they lived in is generally not conducive to preserving cloth from 5,000 years ago. They also had a thriving tool craft, constructing them from stone, bones, horns, antler, clay, and eventually copper. But their main claim to fame is their pottery. The Kukuteni Tripilian culture developed their pottery technology from the LBK, primarily the Buk culture in the East. However, they took the rudimentary pottery skills that the LBK provided and ran away with it. They learned to make the bowls thinner and more balanced. They learned how to heat it at the perfect temperature, and they learned how to make it prettier, employing experimental techniques with depth, creating 3D effects and color schemes and pattern. Basically, the Kukuteni Tripilian culture made all other European Neolithic potters look amateurish with their boss status. They took their clay molding skills and applied it elsewhere, like on furniture and figurines. There's evidence of couches and chairs being made from baked clay in households. There's also a plethora of statues that dot the numerous sites. They made anthropomorphic figurines and zoomorphic figurines. They made more abstract figurines, and they made mother goddess figurines. Many of these figurines were decorated with what claimed to be a Kukuteni Tripilian script. Some of the pottery and figurines do have markings on them that look a whole lot like the Vinca symbols we discussed in the last section. While there are not as many scholars out there exclaiming that these symbols represent the lost Etruscan alphabet like they used to, there is some buzz about these symbols being a proto-writing. Undoubtedly, many of these figurines were somehow associated with the religion of the culture. Countless fetish figurines have been found in ritual burial fashion. There are also figurines found in burnt and unburnt pottery. The earliest sites have a building in the center of the settlement that contained many of these ritually buried figurines, but later sites lack this central religious building. This suggests that the culture, rather than losing its religion, maintained religious conviction on a personal level, rather than at a priestly level. Also, since the culture is believed to have been completely egalitarian with next to no social stratification, these central buildings would have been somewhat pointless because there wouldn't have been a priest class to maintain them anyway. In addition to the fetish figurines, there are mother goddess figurines everywhere, and the Kukuteni Tripilians had a fondness for bird goddesses. Some suggest that this implies some type of rebirth motif. Another reason for this suggestion is of the strange practice of village birding. Every 60-odd years or so, the Kukuteni Tripilians would step out of their village and burn it to the ground. Then they would rebuild the settlement exactly as it was before. This odd behavior has been denoted as a belief in cyclical existence, i.e. life, death, rebirth. Puduri, a settlement in Romania, seems to have suffered this fate at least 13 times. The Kukuteni Tripilians would eventually evolve into a Chalcolithic culture, and they would go on to master the use of copper, and then master the use of bronze, and become a Bronze Age group. Interestingly, the pottery they were so good at during the peaceful Neolithic age goes down the tubes once they can create man-killing copper and bronze weaponry. As fantastic as this culture was, it was not meant to last forever, and there are three main theories about its dissolution. First, the theory that came from Mirza Gumbutas, a Lithuanian-American archaeologist and expert on these cultures, put forth a theory about old Europe and Indo-European invaders. I won't go into this now, but look for a blog post sometime in the future on the subject. Basically, though, her theory said that indigenous Neolithic cultures like the Kukuteni Tripilians were a matriarchal and peaceful society that were wiped out by the aggressive and warlike patriarchal society of the Kurgans. The second theory comes from J.P. Mallory, an Irish-American archaeologist and contemporary expert on the subject. Mirza Gumbutas was a 20th century archaeologist that passed away in 1994. Mallory, however, suggested that rather than facing a violent end, the Kurgan culture and the Kukuteni Tripilian culture slowly blended together. This is known as the gradual assimilation theory. He cites evidence that the Kurgan culture had drifted westward out of the steppes as far as Transylvania in Romania, and that the two cultures had coexisted for over 2,000 years in some type of peaceful manner. He also cites the existence of the Ustavo culture along the Black Sea between the Bug and Danube rivers in Romania as further evidence. The Ustavo appeared to have been a hybrid of the Kukuteni Tripilian and Kurgan culture. Third, There is a theory that suggests that the Kurgan did in fact take over the Kukulcani Tripilians, but not through war. This ecological collapse theory states that the climate of the region deteriorated into basically a dust bowl, effectively making it impossible to farm. The Kukulcani Tripilians died out because they were farmers, and the Kurgan culture survived and then thrived with the extra land because they were primarily herdsmen. This brings us about to the midway point of the Neolithic European podcast. However, as we're stretching the boundaries of most people's attention span, I think we'll hold off and hit Central West Europe and the British Isles next time. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again soon. Don't forget to email the show at thehistoryofeuropepodcast@gmail.com or leave us a comment on the blog, thehistoryofeurope.blogspot.com. Thanks again.